Evolutionary Psychology, Part 1, The Science of Human Nature, Lecture 10, The Evolution of Human Sexuality.
In the previous lecture, we discussed the origin and evolution of sex, and briefly discussed the effects of sexual selection on the reproductive physiology and behavior of vertebrates. In particular, we discussed Robert Trivers' theory of parental investment in sexual selection, which predicts patterns of mating behavior on the basis of how much resources females and males invest in their offspring. Trivers pointed out that the amount of resources that females invest in the production of eggs, gestation, hatching or giving birth to, and raising offspring is generally much greater than the amount that males invest. This means that females have more to lose by not being discriminating in their choice of mates. In most cases, therefore, access to reproductive females is the only limit to male reproductive success. This, in turn, means that females shape the adaptations of males by choosing which males they will allow to mate with them. Overall, female choice determines the mating system that evolves in most animal species. This means that there's a tendency towards the evolution of polygamous mating systems in most animals, and especially in vertebrates, which, being larger and longer-lived, require more resources to successfully raise offspring to maturity. This is because females who choose to mate with males, who control more resources that can be provided to offspring, or who defend larger territories within which females can obtain those resources, produce more offspring themselves, and therefore pass on to their female offspring the tendency to choose the same kinds of successful males as mates. Having been fathered by more successful males, the male offspring of such females also pass on their attractive features to their sons, and so polygyny, that is, mating between a male and more than one female, results in increased reproductive success for both females and males who practice it. As long as a male can either directly or indirectly provide the necessary resources, it doesn't matter if the males that females choose already have other female mates. As I noted in the previous lecture, from a female's evolutionary perspective, it's better to have part of a successful male than all of an unsuccessful one. In other words, sexual selection based on female choice drives the evolution of polygyny in most vertebrates. And so, the burning question becomes, what are humans? Monogamous or polygamous? In Western culture, the answer provided by both society and the overwhelming majority of individuals was, until recently, well, monogamous, of course. This was true despite clear historical evidence, as this has not always been the case. For example, both the Judeo-Christian Bible and the Muslim Quran provide examples of patriarchs who are polygamists and do not explicitly prohibit polygamy at all. Indeed, the Quran explicitly allows it under certain conditions, conditions that you could easily call ecological conditions. Monogamy as a social rule in Western culture seems to have coincided with the rise of urban culture in the city-states surrounding the Mediterranean about 3 millennia ago. Today, this is what most people in the West say they are. However, a more interesting question is, what are most people doing, and why are they doing it? Although Freud and most of his followers based much of their theory of psychoanalysis on the overwhelming importance of sex, they rarely addressed this question. Neither did behaviorists in general, and most supporters of the standard social science model considered the question moot, since whatever people were could be explained purely by reference to their upbringing. If they're raised monogamous, they'll be monogamous. If they're raised polygamous, they'll be polygamous, and therefore could be changed by simply changing their environment. In other words, until recently, the prevailing opinion was that humans were either naturally monogamous, or at least most of them were, or that they were socially programmed to be monogamous. Either way, the general assumption was that humans are monogamous, despite obvious exceptions. Furthermore, humans ought to be monogamous as well, either because their religion or society or laws said so, or because that was obviously the best way to be. Although we will return to this question in one of our last lectures in this series, we will not be addressing the question of what we ought to be doing in the next few lectures. Once again, we will limit ourselves to what we are doing, as far as we can tell. The first serious challenge to the largely unexamined assumption that humans are monogamous, and that this is the way we are naturally, was made by Donald Simons in his book, The Evolution of Human Sexuality, published in 1979. Simons based his analysis of the evolution of human sexuality on Robert Trivor's theory of parental investment in sexual selection. Central to Simons' theoretical analysis was the idea that, and I quote, with respect to sexuality, there is a female human nature and a male human nature, and these natures are extraordinarily different. Because the sexual desires and dispositions that were adaptive for either sex were, for the other, tickets to reproductive oblivion. This is because males are in constant competition with other males for access to females. And females are in constant competition with other females to produce optimal numbers of offspring. While it is possible for females and males to have aligned interests, it is certainly not guaranteed. In particular, if it is possible for females to successfully raise their offspring with little or no help from a male, then there's no selective pressure whatsoever for males to provide any help. And those males who father the most offspring with the largest number of females will have a higher reproductive success than males that do not father as many offspring. And furthermore, this will happen even if the females and males in question do not know that their behavior affects their reproductive success. A basic principle in evolutionary biology, and especially in evolutionary psychology, is there are both proximate and ultimate causes for most adaptations, including behavioral adaptations. It is important to keep these two levels of causation in mind when considering the behaviors and other adaptations of organisms. The proximate cause of a behavior is the specific sensory, nervous, motor, and hormonal activities that produce the behavior. For example, in most animals, and certainly in humans, the reason that both females and males court and eventually copulate is quite simply because generally it feels good. That is, the sensory, nervous, motor, and hormonal systems of females and males produce physical sensations during courtship and copulation that are strongly positively reinforcing. Each step in the chain of behaviors encourages the participants to perform the next step, with the outcome, if everything is working correctly and the participants are not interrupted, that copulation is successful and the female becomes pregnant. The technical term for most animals is gravid. And in the fullest of time, the female produces offspring. Once the offspring are produced, the males and females generally perform behaviors and have physical and chemical characteristics that encourage their parents or parent to provide them with sufficient resources to develop into sexually mature adults themselves. Nowhere in this entire chain of events is it necessary for any of the participants to know or understand or predict any of their actions, or whether, if they're performed correctly, that they'll have the effect of producing fertile offspring that will develop to sexual maturity and produce fertile offspring themselves. Indeed, even in some human societies, the link between copulation and reproduction has not been entirely understood, nor does it need to be for it to work. The ultimate cause of a behavior is the particular evolutionary process by which the capacity for that behavior came to evolve, including, but not necessarily limited to, natural and sexual selection. For example, in all animals, and again, certainly in humans, the reason that both females and males court and eventually copulate is that in the past, those individuals that did so successfully, survived and reproduced more often than those that didn't. That is, the sensory, nervous, motor, and hormonal systems of females and males produce positively reinforcing physical sensations during courtship and copulation because, in the past, doing so had the effect of eventually producing more offspring with the same capabilities. Again, it is not necessary for any of the participants to know that their long-term evolutionary interest will be promoted by such behaviors, only that this, in fact, be the case. To make an analogy that might illuminate this difference, the proximate cause for arriving at Grandma's house for dinner is the chemical and mechanical processes that cause the family car to move on down the highway. The gas exploding in the cylinders, the pistons pumping up and down, the drive shaft spinning, the wheels turning, and so forth. In biological terms, these are the sensory, nervous, motor, and hormonal processes that cause the behaviors to happen. In other words, anatomical and physiological processes move animals during their lifetime. By contrast, the ultimate cause for arriving at Grandma's house for dinner is the driver of the car, who steers it to its destination and could have steered any car there. The details of the process of how the car works are not relevant to the details of how the driver gets the car to Grandma's. In biological terms, this process is natural and sexual selection, working over many generations of organisms, preserving those proximate mechanisms that have the effect of maximizing reproductive success. In other words, natural and sexual selection in particular environments steer the evolution of animals over deep evolutionary time. In long-lived animals, such as humans, gestation takes a long time, and therefore fertilization and birth are separated by long periods of time, during which, quite a lot can happen. Therefore, it's probably just as well that the proximate causes of behavior, including sexual behavior, work as well as they do. Natural selection, although it has the long-term effect of producing evolutionary adaptations, can only work directly on organisms through proximate mechanisms. Indeed, there are reasons to believe that in humans, knowledge of the evolutionary implications of one's actions can actually inhibit behaviors that are encouraged by proximate mechanisms. Therefore, it is likely that the various behaviors that men and women perform in the course of courtship and copulation are driven by proximate processes and neither require the conscious intent of producing offspring nor even produce any awareness of that ultimate effect at all. Keeping all this in mind, now let's look at Donald Simon's findings and conclusions vis-a-vis the evolution of human sexuality. First, Simon's asserted that evolutionary explanations of human sexuality are, like all scientific explanations, value-free. It is very important to keep in mind this basic principle of evolutionary psychology. Just because a behavior is a certain way doesn't necessarily mean that it ought to be that way. Confusing is statements and ought statements is a common problem and has led to no end of misunderstanding of evolutionary psychology. Second, humans, like virtually all other animals, do not mate promiscuously. Both males and females are harmed by indiscriminate mating, especially females. Intrasexual competition, that is, competition within a sex, is generally much more intense among males than females. In pre-agricultural societies, male-male competition over females is the most common cause of male-male violence and male-on-male murder. Males are more likely to be polygynous than monogamous, whereas females can accommodate to almost any mating system, monogamous, polygynous, polyandrous, and polygynandrous circumstances. It is important to note that these refer to mating behavior, but not necessarily to the production of offspring. In other words, males seek to have multiple sex partners regardless of whether or not, or even in spite of the fact, that this results in more children. By contrast, so long as they can be successfully raised, females are relatively indifferent as to how many fathers they have for their children. Males almost universally experience sexual jealousy of their mates, whereas females can generally accommodate to their mates, having other mates. This is because males who tolerate their mates copulating with other males father fewer offspring and may provide resources for offspring that aren't theirs. Whereas if females can successfully raise their offspring, it doesn't matter who else their mates are mating with. Males are more likely to be sexually aroused by visual stimuli, especially the sight of female sex characteristics and especially genitals, whereas females are more likely to be sexually aroused by sexual fantasies and stories. This conclusion is strongly supported by observations of the kinds of pornography preferred by males, that is, visual with minimal narrative, versus females, narrative even if it's not visual. Physical features of females, especially those indicating youth and health, are most sexually arousing for males, whereas characteristics indicating influence and power, but also care and nurturance, especially for children, are more attractive to females. Males who mate with young, healthy women father more children, whereas females who mate with males that can provide resources for their children have more success doing so. Males are more likely to seek and to be gratified by sexual variety than females. The more females a male mates with, the more children he will have. Whereas multiple mates do not generally mean more children for females because of their relatively limited reproductive capacity. According to Simons, orgasms are an adaptation in males, but probably an accidental side effect in females. Obviously, the ability to orgasm is completely sterilizing in males. But unless orgasm increases fertility in females, it's neither selected for nor against. Unlike most other mammals, human females do not show outward signs of ovulation. Interestingly, Simons does not present a strong evolutionary explanation as to why this might be the case. Other people have done so, and we'll get to their work later. Finally, in virtually all human societies, copulation is viewed as a service that females provide to males, rather than vice versa. This is both an observed pattern in human societies and a consequence of the other effects already enumerated. Like many other evolutionary psychologists, Simons also asserted that the foregoing behavioral adaptations for sexual behavior in humans probably evolved during the Pleistocene and have not changed significantly since then. This is because the Pleistocene lasted a very long time, millions of years, long enough for natural and sexual selection to adapt our ancestors' sensory, nervous, and motor systems, whereas there has not been sufficient time, less than 40,000 years, since then for this to happen. An important implication of this view is that our behavior today may not make any sense at all under current conditions, especially in the context of the recent development and use of artificial contraceptives, and the development of human societies characterized by large, relatively mobile populations, and increasing anonymity. Simons, like other evolutionary psychologists, and like Darwin before them, concluded that the human mind is largely a product of evolution by natural and especially sexual selection, rather than pure learning as asserted in the standard social science model. In particular, the mind and the behaviors that it produces and guides is driven and guided by emotions, rather than the other way around. Simons' pioneering work was both widely praised and just as widely condemned. From the standpoint of doing science, Simon's book was primarily theoretical, providing a coherent set of testable hypotheses for the evolution of human sexuality, supported by empirical information, if it was available. By and large, such empirical support was not available, since the kind of frank examination of human sexuality that would be necessary to either support or refute Simon's proposals had not yet been done up until then. Furthermore, most scientists assumed, as did most of Western society, that monogamy was both natural and universal, and that polygamy was abnormal, being found in only a relatively small number of animal species and primitive societies. Simon's book stimulated an avalanche of new studies into animal and human mating systems, motivated by both the desire to verify and extend his hypotheses and to prove them wrong. In 1981, Sarah Blaffer Hardy published The Woman That Never Evolved, at least partly in response to Simon's. Hardy began her book with an analysis of the asymmetry between female and male parental investment, similar to what Trivers used as the basis for his theory of parental investment in sexual selection. Although she seemed intent on challenging the views of Simon's and other male sociobiologists, in this chapter at least, she came to essentially the same conclusion as Trivers, that the asymmetry between female and male parental investment selects for different sexual behaviors in females and males. Much of Hardy's book is a catalog of female behavior in non-human primates, from prosimians, things like indries and lemurs and so forth, through monkeys, especially some of the smaller monkeys of South America and Southeast Asia, and ending with apes, gibbons, gorillas, chimpanzees, and orangutans. Much of this section of Hardy's book is taken up with providing examples of monogamy among primates, in contrast, apparently, with Simon's emphasis on polygamy, and especially male polygyny. Hardy also spent some time pointing out that female primates seem not to compete with each other anywhere as near as often nor as intensely as primate males do. The centerpiece of her book is an in-depth discussion of a behavior pattern that Hardy herself is credited with discovering and analyzing. Infanticide by males in polygynous primates. During fieldwork studying Hanuman langurs in northwest India, Hardy observed a consistent pattern of infanticide among the polygynous groups of langurs living in and around a school for the blind. Groups of langurs, usually referred to as troops, consist primarily of females and their young, with usually a single dominant male that mates with most or all of the sexually mature females in the troop. Males often compete with other males, especially young males from outside a troop, challenging older males for dominance in the troop. If a usurping younger male manages to displace the dominant male of a troop, he then immediately and systematically kills all of the nursing and immature infants in the troop, usually by biting them. This causes the females to stop nursing and to begin reproductively cycling, at which point the new male impregnates them. Although it seems quite ghoulish, such infanticide has a straightforward evolutionary explanation. The males that do this have more offspring than males that do not. Indeed, a male that kills the offspring of the former master of a troop lowers his rival's fitness while simultaneously raising his own. Hardy also points out that females rarely intervene in this behavior as their own sons, by the dominant troop leaders, also benefit from this same behavior pattern. Hardy's discovery was once considered very controversial, but the evidence from extensive natural history data collected since the 1970s has confirmed her hypothesis. More than confirmed it, in fact, this pattern has now been found in many species of primates and in many other mammals, including African lions, most bears, other carnivores. So common is infanticide by newly established dominant males that behaviors once thought odd or perverse, such as the tendency for female bears to violently repel males who stray too close to their cubs, are now subsumed under the general phenomenon of non-paternal male infanticide. Hardy concluded her book with an argument against Simon's suggestion that the female orgasm is not adaptive. However, a close reading of the two books reveals that Simons doesn't actually claim that female orgasm is non-adaptive, only that there's little evidence either way, unlike the obvious adaptiveness of male orgasm without which males cannot inseminate females. Hardy herself points out not all women orgasm. Statistically, between 30% and 50% do not, or do not consistently. However, she does not present evidence to indicate how female orgasm could function as an adaptation, for example, by increasing the probability of fertilization by altering sperm intake. Hardy's point in writing The Woman That Never Evolved appears, therefore, to have been threefold. To point out that monogamy does exist, at least among some primates. To show that polygyny has what we would consider to be negative consequences, especially a tendency towards non-paternal male infanticide, and to suggest that female-human orgasms may not be entirely non-adaptive, although it's not clear what alternative she's argued for. The title of her book, The Woman Who Never Evolved, refers to her assertion that since there's little evidence that females in other primate species have either competed for dominance, formed strong cooperative groups, defended their offspring against the depredations of dominant males, or evolved a consistent ability to orgasm, if females want to accomplish these things, they will need to do it, well, unnaturally, I guess. While this conclusion resonates with one that I will discuss in much more detail later, the idea that our evolved nature does not and cannot give us our ethics. On retrospect, Hardy's only lasting contribution to the understanding of the evolution of human sexual behavior is the suggestion that non-paternal male infanticide may be adaptive, at least for males. As we will see, this suggestion was followed up by evolutionary psychologists with, again, predictably controversial results. Her other apparent claim to show that monogamy is not entirely unknown among primates, and by implication may not be unnatural for humans, has not fared well at all. Indeed, subsequent natural history studies have so undermined the Victorian view of natural monogamy that sociobiologists David Barish and Judith Lipton could, with considerable justification, title their 2001 book, The Myth of Monogamy, Fidelity and Infidelity in Animals and People. Extensive study of the mating patterns of many animals, from damselflies to whales, has shown that monogamy is by far the least common mating behavior in the kingdom Animalia. Indeed, the question is not, are animals, including humans, monogamous, but rather, why does monogamy occur at all? However, unlike a naive rendering of Trivers' theory might produce, the overwhelming weight of the natural history data collected since 1980 tends to support the idea that multiple mating is the rule among both sexes in the vast majority of animals, especially vertebrates. In particular, Barish and Lipton emphasize the mating behavior called extrapair copulation, in which females and males copulate with another individual besides the one with whom they're socially mated. Using a wealth of examples, they showed that both females and males can increase their reproductive success by pursuing what is essentially a mixed mating strategy, that is, mating with at least one partner, but pursuing extrapair copulations with as many others as the contingencies of life might allow. Using an updated interpretation of Trivers' original theory of parental investment, Barish and Lipton showed that the observations of myriad extrapair copulations among animals, formerly thought to be monogamous, can be explained in both females and males, but for different evolutionary reasons. For males, extrapair copulations are strictly a numbers game. The more females a male can copulate with, the more offspring he'll father. Therefore, males who inherit whatever behavioral tendency led to their conception as the result of extrapair copulation will pass this tendency on to their sons. For females, extrapair copulations are part of a much more complex calculus of costs and benefits, all of which ultimately reduce to maximizing fitness among a limited number of offspring. Since females, by their biology, can only have a limited number of offspring, regardless of how many times they copulate or with whom they do so, then the tendency to seek extra pair copulations to evolve would require that doing so would increase the probability that that limited number of offspring would have a better chance of survival as a result. Barish and Lipton point out two ways that this can happen. Mating with multiple males can increase the genetic variation between a female's offspring, and it can also result in obtaining resources for more than one male. Two further benefits to females as the result of extra pair copulations have since been suggested. Mating with multiple males might confuse the males as to which male is the father, thereby forestalling the kind of non-paternal male infanticide discovered by Hardy and others. Mating with multiple males can also set up the conditions necessary for sperm competition. That is, if multiple mating is the rule, then those males who produce the largest quantity of the most viable sperm will father the most offspring, which will benefit the sons of females who encourage such sperm competition. For centuries, people in Western culture assumed that they, along with most other animals, were naturally monogamous. This assumption was clearly not based on observation, but rather on what could be called wishful ethicizing. That is, because the dominant moral code in Western culture prescribed monogamy, the fact that it was natural simply reinforced the moral code. Who wants to do things that most people would consider to be unnatural? Selectively noticing examples of apparent monogamy among non-human animals, while dismissing examples of polygamy as perverse or unnatural or at best rare, was essentially reifying rather than verifying that humans were also naturally monogamous. Well, as we will see in the next lecture, such reification is no longer an option. True monogamy, in the lifelong version prescribed by Western moral codes, is almost unknown among non-human animals. But wait, you protest, that's other animals. We're different. Well, wait and see.
This ends Lecture 10.